morning, afternoon, or evening, depending on when you're joining us for this special deep dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Today, we're jumping into the federal news update for Tuesday, September 9th, 2025. Our goal here is really to cut through all the noise. We want to distill the most important actions, the activities of the U.S. federal government, starting from September 6, 2025.
And not just list them, right? We want to explore the impacts, the implications, really get into the granular detail.
Exactly. This isn't just a recap. It's about understanding the why and the how behind what's happening. Think of it as a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed.
Without getting totally bogged down.
Precisely. Okay, let's dig in. Yes. The executive branch in action, decisive presidential directives and domestic initiatives. First up, and this one is, well, pretty significant, a major move from the executive branch, the rebranding of the U.S. military.
Yeah, this is big. On September 5th, President Trump signed an executive order. It renames the Department of Defense to the Department of War.
And the Secretary of Defense is now the Secretary of War.
Correct. And this isn't just, you know, press release. It was formally filed for publication in the Federal Register on September 9th. That makes it official policy.
And the rollout was fast, wasn't it?
Incredibly fast. The White House, the Pentagon, they adopted the new terms almost immediately. You saw defense.gov suddenly redirecting to war.gov.
Yeah.
Social media updated practically overnight.
Right.
The administration's justification centers on projecting peace through strength.
They're talking about historical resonance.
Mm-hmm. Connecting it to past American military victories. They framed it explicitly as pushing back against what they describe as a woke and overly defensive military mindset.
A mindset they feel dilutes the mission.
That's the argument. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth really hammered this, emphasizing a renewed warrior ethos and a focus on maximum lethality.
It definitely sends a clear message. But what does this signal beyond just the name? Is there a deeper shift in national security philosophy here?
I think you have to see it that way. It's deeply symbolic, yes. But symbols carry enormous weight, especially in international relations and domestic perception.
Right.
And look at the legal mechanics. The EO calls Department of War a secondary title for public communication.
Yeah. So that avoids needing immediate congressional action, since only Congress can actually rename a department.
Exactly. It's clever. But the EO also directs the Secretary of War to report back in 60 days on the legislative steps needed for a permanent change.
So it's a phased approach, pushing the boundaries.
Precisely. And the real insight, I think, is how this rebrands the military's public identity, its purpose. It aligns perfectly with their broader campaign against so-called woke policies.
We've seen that elsewhere, right? The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, that EO on preventing woke AI.
It all fits together. It's about shaping a specific cultural and political worldview, and the military's public image is now squarely part of that strategy. It's a powerful rhetorical move.
Signaling a more, maybe, aggressive posture.
That's certainly how many are interpreting it. And predictably, it sparked a fierce debate. You have opinion pieces calling it wrong and dangerous, while the administration frames it as essential for, well, winning wars.
And that immediate adoption of the terms, even before the Federal Register publication, that really shows how fast the executive branch can shift perception, doesn't it?
It's a textbook example of executive power shaping the narrative almost instantly.
Okay, moving from defense to economics, another major development, a new U.S.-Japan framework. President Trump signed EO 14345 on September 4th.
Yes, implementing the United States-Japan agreement.
Yeah.
Officially published on the 9th. This puts into effect that big trade framework they announced back in July.
And this is a pretty complex deal, right? Managed trade?
Very much so. It really feels like a blueprint for how this administration wants to restructure global economic ties. For the U.S. side, it establishes a baseline 15% tariff on almost all Japanese imports.
And that's retroactive.
Retroactive to August 7th, yes. Tariffs on Japanese cars and auto parts also dropped to 15%. There are some exemptions, you know, aerospace, certain generic drugs, natural resources the U.S. can't easily get.
But things like steel and aluminum still have those separate higher tariffs.
Correct. Those remain in place.
Okay, so what about Japan's commitments? It wasn't just about tariffs, was it?
Oh, far from it. Japan's commitments are huge. First, a $550 billion investment fund.
$550 billion?
Billion, yes. For U.S. critical industries, semiconductors, critical minerals, energy, and significantly, the president gets to select which industries.
Wow. Okay. What else?
They've also committed to buying $8 billion worth of U.S. agricultural goods annually, Think corn, soybeans, fertilizer, bioethanol, plus a 75% increase in buying U.S. rice.
Big news for U.S. agriculture.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And they've agreed to accept U.S.-made vehicles meeting U.S. safety standards without extra testing and to purchase U.S.-made commercial aircraft and defense equipment. It's a sweeping package.
So the White House is obviously spinning this as a major win. Jobs, manufacturing, reduced trade deficit.
Understandably, yes. They claim hundreds of thousands of jobs, expanded domestic manufacturing, leveling the playing field, all that.
But for Japan, they avoided the rumored 25% tariff, but 15% is still high. What's the actual impact?
It's still a serious challenge for their export-heavy economy. Nomura Research Institute put out an estimate suggesting a potential 0.55% drop in Japan's real GDP.
Could that mean recession?
Possibly a mild recession, yes. It's widely viewed over there as a major concession, essentially made under duress to avoid something worse.
And this signals a bigger shift, you said, away from free trade.
Absolutely. This marks a significant move away from the post-WWII model of multilateral free trade agreements. It's a pivot towards what you could call managed trade.
Using tariffs as leverage.
Exactly. Using tariffs to basically compel foreign governments to directly fund U.S. industrial policy priorities. This concentrates enormous power over international capital flows right within the executive branch.
Allowing the president to direct investment.
Precisely. Into favored sectors. And this could very well be the template for future negotiations. Think the EU, South Korea, other major trading partners with surpluses.
But there are downsides, potentially. Higher prices.
Well, yes. We have to consider the broader economic context. The Yale Budget Lab did an analysis estimating the administration's 2025 tariffs overall could raise U.S. consumer prices by about 1.7% in the short run.
Ouch.
And potentially reduce long-run U.S. real GDP by maybe 0.4%. So there are targeted benefits for some domestic sectors, but also these wider economic trade-offs to consider.
A really fundamental reordering of global economic relationships. Okay, let's shift to the domestic front. The administration pushed forward several initiatives focused on faith, security, and consumer protection.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the America Prays Initiative, launched September 8th.
Yes, at the White House Religious Liberty Commission meeting, President Trump urged the formation of nationwide weekly prayer groups, at least 10 people per group.
And the goal is to keep this going until 2026.
Until the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Yes. They even released a 22-page booklet with guidelines, making it quite concrete.
And this was linked to school prayer guidance.
Explicitly. An announcement came with it that the Department of Education would issue new guidance aimed at protecting prayer in public schools.
How is this being received?
Predictably divided. Supporters see it as restoring faith's proper role in public life. They point to things like the administration's list of top 100 victories for people of faith.
What, critics?
Critics are very concerned. They condemn it as advancing Christian nationalism, arguing it undermines the Establishment Clause, the constitutional separation of church and state. They see it as exclusionary.
And it builds on previous directives.
Yes. Like that July memo about federal workers persuading colleagues on religious beliefs. It's part of a pattern.
Okay, also on the domestic front, protecting U.S. nationals abroad, a new EO.
Right. Signed September 5th, hit the public inspection list on the 9th. Strengthening efforts to protect U.S. nationals from wrongful detention abroad.
What does it do?
It creates a new system to deter foreign governments from wrongfully detaining Americans. It allows the U.S. to designate countries as state sponsors of wrongful detention.
And that triggers sanctions.
Exactly. Visa bans, travel restrictions, limits on exports. It gives the executive branch another tool in its diplomatic toolkit for these difficult cases.
Interestingly, amid these more unilateral actions, we also saw some bipartisan legislation signed on September 5th.
Yes, that's right. H.R. 2808, the Homebuyers Privacy Protection Act.
What does that do?
It amends the Fair Credit Reporting Act to restrict the sale of what are called trigger leads.
Trigger leads.
Yeah, basically, when you apply for a mortgage, your financial data could be sold almost immediately to other lenders. This bill aims to stop that, or at least limit it significantly.
So fewer unsolicited calls and emails when you're trying to buy a house.
That's the idea. And it passed the Senate unanimously. Quite rare these days. A clear consumer protection win. It should take effect in about 6 months after the final regulations are sorted out.
And there was another bill.
Yes, H.R. 2170. Less controversial, designating a VA outpatient clinic in Toms River, New Jersey, in honor of Leonard G. Bud Lamel.
So looking at these actions together, the unilateral moves like Department of War, America Prays, versus signing this bipartisan privacy bill. What's the dynamic here?
It suggests what some might call a bifurcated mode of governance.
You know.
Meaning the administration seems willing to embrace consensus and bipartisanship when it fits a particular narrative like populist consumer protection.
But for its core agenda.
For the core transformative agenda items, it heavily relies on executive power, often bypassing the need for legislative agreement. So bipartisanship might be more of an opportunistic tactic than a core governing principle.
Okay, let's move to immigration enforcement and cartel operations. These have been areas of intense focus and, well, aggressive action.
Definitely. And a key trigger here was the Supreme Court ruling, which we'll get into more detail on later. But it essentially gave DHS a green light for intensified aggressive enforcement.
And we're seeing that play out now.
Yes. The White House is ramping up immigration enforcement in major cities. Chicago is a key example, part of something called Operation Midway Blitz, which kicked off September 8th.
How are local officials reacting?
Strongly. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker blasted it, called it an attempt to scare Illinoisans. He directly linked it to the Department of War, rebranding, and federal funding cuts, even accusing the president of defunding the police.
That's quite a charge.
It highlights the deep political divisions. Pritzker cited polls in Illinois showing significant opposition, around 58%, to using the National Guard in cities for this purpose.
And separate from the current operations, we learned more about a controversial deal involving Venezuelan migrants.
Yes. Details emerged through litigation about an agreement between the Trump administration and El Salvador.
To imprison Venezuelan migrants there.
Correct. A 5-page agreement obtained by Democracy Forward showed the U.S. paid El Salvador $4.76 million to house up to 300 Venezuelan men for at least a year in the CECOP mega prison.
Which has a notorious reputation.
Infamous for allegations of torture, yes. And critically, the agreement barred any U.S. funds from being used for legal counsel for these detained Venezuelans.
No lawyers funded by the U.S.
None. It also forbade funds for reproductive health care or any assistance for asylum seekers. Many of these men, some reportedly with no criminal history, were held for months and eventually sent back to Venezuela in July in a prisoner swap.
What was the legal justification used initially?
The administration invoked the Alien Enemies Act, arguing it gave them broad wartime powers to deport alleged gang members without trial.
Did that hold up in court?
Largely no. Subsequent litigation, including a ruling from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, found that the administration exceeded the bounds of that act. There were even reports via a Justice Department whistleblower of a senior official essentially saying they'd defy court orders to block flights.
That raises serious questions, doesn't it, about how these tactics fit with U.S. foreign policy and humanitarian norms?
Absolutely. Especially when dealing with vulnerable migrant populations and outsourcing detention to facilities with questionable human rights records.
Okay, shifting gears slightly but related. Anti-cartel operations. The DEA made a big announcement.
Yes, on Monday, September 8th, they announced over 600 arrests linked to the Sinaloa cartel. This was from a 5-day operation back in late August.
And the seizures were significant.
Huge. Over 420 firearms. Nearly $13 million in cash and assets. And the drug haul was massive. Over 700,000 counterfeit pills, almost 1,000 pounds of fentanyl powder, nearly 5,000 pounds of meth, over 16,000 pounds of cocaine, 36 pounds of heroin.
This fits into a broader strategy, right? Designating cartels as terrorist organizations.
Exactly. The administration designated Sinaloa and 7 other Latin American gangs as terrorist organizations earlier this year. And there were reports last month that the president authorized the Pentagon to actually use military force against these cartels.
Using the military against cartels.
That's the direction. Border czar Tom Homan defended it publicly, arguing cartels have killed more Americans than all terrorist groups combined. He literally said, we're at war in the cartel.
And we saw an example of this military approach recently.
Yes, that U.S. military kinetic strike last week. They hit a suspected drug vessel in the Caribbean, killing 11 alleged members of the Trindade-Aragua gang, described as narco-terrorists.
How was that received internationally?
Condemnation from Venezuela's President Maduro, calling it criminal. And even domestically, there's debate. Senator Rand Paul criticized VP Vance's comments, supporting killing cartel members without trial, raising due process concerns.
So it's a strategy that blurs the lines between law enforcement and military action.
Very much so. Applying military tools and justifications to problems traditionally handled by law enforcement, which brings up significant legal and ethical questions.
Okay, let's pivot to the federal workforce itself. There have been initiatives around efficiency, but also some serious friction.
Yes, a major story broke on September 8th involving FEMA staff.
The ones who signed the Katrina Declaration.
Exactly. That was a public dissent letter in late August warning about changes at FEMA under the current administration. Now, some of those signatories are claiming DHS retaliated against them.
How?
By placing them on administrative leave last week, violating whistleblower protection laws, according to their lawyers.
How many employees are we talking about?
Over 190 current and former FEMA employees signed the letter. About 36 current employees signed with their names attached. Those are the ones reportedly placed on leave.
And they're fighting this.
Yes. Their lawyers sent a letter on September 2nd to Congress, the Office of Special Counsel, the DHS Inspector General, calling it illegal retaliatory personnel actions. They want reinstatement.
One of them spoke out publicly.
Yes. Abby McIlraith, an emergency management specialist. She emphasized wanting to get back to work, especially during hurricane season.
How did DHS respond?
Secretary Kristi Noem dismissed the signatories as bureaucrats who presided over decades of inefficiency and are just resisting reform. She also pointed out McIlraith's relatively short time at the agency.
What do legal experts say?
Well, Michael Fallings and Kevin Owen discuss the complexities distinguishing protected whistleblower disclosures from simple policy disagreements. Owen noted that putting someone on immediate administrative leave often suggests smoke and fire to whistleblower investigators, implying there might be substance to the claims.
Is there precedent for this kind of action?
There is. Earlier this summer, the EPA fired some employees and suspended others for signing a similar dissent letter. The EPA cited a zero-tolerance policy for career officials using their agency position and title to unlawfully undermine the will of the American public.
So it seems like a pattern of cracking down on internal dissent.
It certainly appears that way. A clear signal is being sent to career federal employees about disagreeing publicly with administration policy.
Meanwhile, an appeals court dismissed a case related to probationary employee firings.
Yes, a state's case challenging those firings was dismissed. Interestingly, Judge Benjamin noted that while the fired employees suffered the most, the agencies themselves failed by carrying out what was effectively a widespread reduction in force, or RIF, without giving the legally required advance notice.
And that lack of notice impacted the states.
Right, because it hindered their ability to prepare and provide support services for those laid off federal workers. So it highlights a failure by the federal government to follow its own rules during these workforce reductions.
Amidst all this pressure, there's also an initiative trying to capture departing employees' knowledge.
Yes, the Departure Dialogues Project.
Yep.
It's a collaboration between the POPVOX Foundation and others.
What's the goal?
To collect insights from federal employees who are leaving government service about what works and what doesn't. The idea is to bridge the gap between Congress writing laws and the executive branch actually implementing them.
How does it work?
They're using self-service guided interviews, video, or written, offering anonymity. It focuses on policy observations, operational bottlenecks, statutory barriers to efficiency, things that often get lost in the usual legislative affairs channels.
Trying to help Congress write better, more implementable laws.
Exactly. And fix systemic issues based on ground level experience.
So pulling back, what's the overall picture? Intense pressure on the workforce, whistleblowers, firings, but also these efforts to maybe learn from those leaving. It's contradictory.
It is. A real tension between enforcing top-down control and recognizing the value of institutional knowledge and experience within the federal workforce.
Okay, let's turn to some specific instances of executive scrutiny and controversy that made headlines this week. First, the Jeffrey Epstein birthday book.
Right. On Monday, September 8th, the House Oversight Committee released this leather-bound book. Ghislaine Maxwell apparently compiled it for Epstein's 50th birthday back in 2003.
And it was obtained via subpoena.
Yes, from Epstein's estate.
Yeah.
The contents are, well, highly controversial.
Notes from prominent figures.
Alleged notes, yes. Attributed to President Trump, former President Bill Clinton, Peter Mandelson, the UK ambassador at the time, described as Epstein's best pal, among others.
And the note attributed to President Trump.
It's presented within the outline of a woman's body, has a purported signature, and apparently refers to having certain things in common with Epstein.
How has the White House responded?
Fierce denial. Press Secretary Caroline Levitt called it false on Monday. They reiterated they're still in litigation against the Wall Street Journal, which first reported the book's existence back in July. Speaker Mike Johnson also expressed doubts about its authenticity on Tuesday.
This keeps the Epstein connection in the news.
Definitely. And Epstein's victims are pushing for full disclosure from the administration on any files related to him. They're supporting things like a discharge petition and the Courtney Wilde Crime Victims Reform Act.
So the scandal continues to, as some commentators say, haunt the president.
Yes. And some argue it undercuts the administration's stance on issues like child exploitation, given their promotion of films like Sound of Freedom and their anti-groomer rhetoric. Concerns also persist about potential intelligence community ties and whether powerful people were protected.
Okay, shifting topics slightly, but still on executive power. The third term talk.
Yes, this came up again. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor was asked about it on Tuesday, September 9th. This followed Justice Amy Coney Barrett making comments on Monday.
What was Sotomayor's take?
She agreed the 22nd Amendment, the one limiting presidents to two terms, is currently settled law.
But,
she added a qualification, no one has tried to challenge that. She suggested this leaves some wiggle room until an actual court case happens. She stressed the Constitution itself is the greater law.
And this comes up because the president and his allies have floated the idea.
Repeatedly. Sometimes framed as a joke, sometimes seemingly more serious. It keeps the question alive, even though the 22nd Amendment has been in place since 1951, after FDR's four terms.
Interesting nuance from the justice. Okay, another piece of news. A settlement involving Norfolk Southern and Amtrak.
Right. The Justice Department announced this on Tuesday, September 9th. It's between the Trump administration and Norfolk Southern.
That's it, pal.
Resolving allegations that Norfolk Southern illegally delayed Amtrak passenger trains. Federal law requires freight railroads to give passenger trains priority.
What are the terms?
Norfolk Southern agreed to give all Amtrak trains the highest priority, train their employees on this, require supervisor approval for non-emergency dispatch decisions that could cause delays, and provide detailed delay records for the Crescent route.
And this follows a previous settlement related to the East Palestine derailment.
Yes, a big one in 2024 under the previous administration. That was an EPA settlement worth $310 million covering cleanup costs and penalties related to the 2023 derailment. So continued scrutiny for Norfolk Southern.
We also saw an example of the president's influence on, of all things, corporate branding, Cracker Barrel.
Yeah, it's quite something. Cracker Barrel announced on Tuesday, September 9th, that they're halting restaurant remodels and ditching other rebrand efforts.
Why?
Customer backlash. This came right after they decided in late August to go back to their old logo, also due to pushback. That pushback included public criticism from President Trump himself.
And their stock price dropped.
It did. So it really illustrates the president's ability to sway public opinion and even influence corporate decisions, demonstrating the power of customer voices, especially when amplified by a major political figure.
Finally, before we move to Congress, the White House announced the president's plans for the 9/11 anniversary.
Yes. Announced on Tuesday, September 9th, President Trump will commemorate the 24th anniversary of the September 11th attacks at both the Pentagon and Ground Zero in New York City. Two, the legislative branch. Oversight, budget, and nominations.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to Capitol Hill, the legislative branch. Looking at the period from September 6th to 9th, it seems like floor activity was pretty minimal compared to all the executive action.
That's a fair assessment. Very little happened on the House or Senate floor. The House adjourned on the evening of the 8th, set to reconvene on the 9th. The Senate had one confirmation vote on the 8th. Pretty quiet.
Why so quiet? Is it just the legislative calendar or something else?
A big part of it is that the government is running on autopilot, essentially. Remember that full year continuing resolution, the CRHR 1968, passed back in March.
Right, the stopgap funding measure.
Exactly. It extends the previous fiscal year spending levels all the way through September 30th of this year, 2025. It avoided a shutdown back in March, but it really underscores Congress's inability to pass a normal budget through the regular appropriations process.
They're relying on temporary fixes.
Precisely. And this particular CR also came with a $13 billion cut to non-defense discretionary spending, achieved by eliminating congressional earmarks. Some political scientists, like Philip Wallach, have even argued that in today's hyper-partisan environment, Congress sometimes almost chooses irrelevance as a way to survive, avoiding tough votes.
Creating a vacuum for the executive branch to fill?
That's the theory. and it seems to play out sometimes.
But now that September 30th deadline for the current CR is approaching fast, shutdown talk is back.
It is. Negotiations are definitely heating up. You have some Republican lawmakers publicly urging President Trump to support a clean short-term funding bill.
Meaning no controversial riders.
Right. They want to avoid attaching what they term controversial MAGE priorities that could sink the bill and trigger a shutdown right before the midterms.
What's Speaker Johnson's approach?
On Tuesday the 9th, Speaker Mike Johnson was pushing for what he called an old-school conference committee between the House and Senate.
To do what?
To try and finalize maybe three regular appropriations bills, the ones funding the VA, military construction, agriculture, and maybe the legislative branch itself, and pass those alongside a stopgap funding measure for everything else.
But that conflicts with what some hardliners want.
Yes. Some conservative members, like Representative Andy Harris, are skeptical they can actually negotiate and pass those individual bills in time. They, along with the White House apparently, prefer a longer-term CR, maybe extending into next year.
How are Senate Democrats reacting?
They've called a long-term CR a non-starter. They're worried it would give the Trump administration too much flexibility to shift funds around, potentially zeroing out accounts they don't like or moving money to pet priorities.
They cited specific numbers.
Yes, pointing to about $410 billion in funding they claim the administration has already blocked or redirected. So it highlights this fundamental tension over Congress's control of the purse strings versus executive discretion.
Okay, another budget-related item. Cuts to IT modernization funding in the House Appropriations Bill.
Right. Reported on September 8th. The House version of the Financial Services and General Government Funding Bill includes some significant reductions for federal IT efforts.
Like what?
Well, for the third year in a row, they've zeroed out funding for the Technology Modernization Fund, or TMF. That's a key source agencies use for upgrading legacy systems.
Any other cuts?
The Federal Citizen Services Fund is cut from $75 million down to $55 million in the House bill. That fund supports things like USA.gov and other citizen-facing digital services. They also reduce the IT Oversight Reform Fund.
What's the justification given?
The subcommittee chairman, Dave Joyce, cited fiscal discipline and common sense.
What's the potential impact?
It's going to make it much harder for agencies to find the money for necessary IT upgrades. It could slow down projects like building the Child Tax Credit website or modernizing the WIC program at USDA.
But wasn't there an increase somewhere in cybersecurity funding?
Yes, that's the interesting counterpoint. Funding for the Treasury Department's Cybersecurity Enhancement Account went up significantly from about $36 million to $99 million in the House bill.
For specific things.
Yes. Specifically earmarked for implementing zero trust architecture, that security model, where you don't trust anything by default, plus low-code application development and cloud security.
Why the boost for Treasury specifically?
The committee report expressed serious concerns about Chinese hackers infiltrating Treasury's IT systems. They've even directed Treasury to provide quarterly spending plans for this cybersecurity money. So it's a very targeted investment driven by specific threats, contrasting with the broader cuts elsewhere.
They also cut the National Cyber Director's office budget.
Slightly, yes. The ONCD budget was reduced from about $21.7 million to $18.1 million in the House bill, with language urging them to focus on securing federal data.
Okay, switching gears within the legislative sphere. Pressure is building regarding the Affordable Care Act, specifically the enhanced subsidies.
Yes, the enhanced premium tax credits. They're set to expire January 1st.
And a lot of people rely on those.
Over 22 million Americans currently receive them. They make marketplace health insurance plans much more affordable for many.
What happens if they expire?
The Congressional Budget Office estimates about 4 million people could lose their health insurance entirely by 2034. And for those who keep coverage, premiums could jump significantly, maybe a median increase of 18%.
So huge implications.
Yeah.
How are Republicans approaching this?
It's dividing them. Some GOP members, especially those in competitive districts, are quietly or publicly supporting an extension. They recognize the potential political fallout of letting subsidies expire.
But others disagree.
Yes. Others, like Senator John Cornyn, have suggested they might prefer to narrow the eligibility for the subsidies rather than extend them fully or let them expire completely. It's a really high-stakes debate with massive real-world consequences for healthcare access and affordability.
Okay, let's look at the Senate specifically now. Action on presidential nominations. Leader Thune made an announcement.
Yes, on Monday, September 8th, Senate Majority Leader John Thune said Republicans are prepared to change Senate rules to speed up confirmations for dozens of President Trump's executive branch nominees.
Citing Democratic obstruction.
That's their argument, yes. They say Democrats are blocking almost all of Trump's nominees, forcing Republicans to use up valuable floor time on each individual confirmation vote, even for lower-level positions.
What's the proposed rule change?
The plan is to allow votes on batches or groups of lower-level executive branch nominees, as long as a simple majority agrees. This would bypass the current rule that allows even one senator to hold up a single nominee for days through procedural delays.
How do Democrats respond?
Minority Leader Chuck Schumer argues that Trump's nominees are, in his words, historically bad, and that they require individual debate and scrutiny. They're not just obstruction for obstruction's sake, is their point.
Haven't both parties changed Senate rules before on nominations?
Oh, yes. It's been an incremental process over the years. Democrats triggered the nuclear option in 2013 for executive and lower court nominees. Republicans did it in 2017 for Supreme Court nominees. Schumer warned Republicans they'd regret taking this next step.
What's the potential impact if they do change the rules?
They could potentially confirm over 100 pending nominations just this month. It would significantly accelerate the process of staffing up the executive branch with the president's choices.
Okay, shifting back to the House. Oversight and investigations were also active. There was a hearing on UAPs, unexplained aerial phenomena.
Yes, on Tuesday, September 9th, a House Oversight Subcommittee hearing. Representative Jared Moskowitz, a Democrat from Florida, was quite pointed, accusing the U.S. government of lying about UAPs.
Well, evidence was presented.
Several military veterans testified about encounters they'd had. There was even new video shown, allegedly, of a UAP off the coast of Yemen from October 2024.
Moskowitz highlighted the credibility of the witnesses.
Yes, pointing out their impeccable records, which he argued makes it harder for the government to just dismiss their accounts or obfuscate. Another striking piece of evidence was a video purportedly showing a flying orb being hit by a Hellfire missile.
And it just kept going.
Apparently, it continued on its trajectory. It's all part of a push for greater government transparency on a subject that's long been taboo or classified.
Another investigation getting attention. The re-examination of January 6th.
Right. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries issued a warning to Republicans on Monday, September 8th. He said they would regret their decision to create a new committee to investigate the January 6th attack.
This is after the original committee issued its report blaming President Trump.
Yes, 3 years later. Republicans voted recently to establish this new investigative panel. Their stated goal is essentially to exonerate President Trump, arguing the previous committee unfairly targeted him.
And Democrats plan to participate?
Yes. But Jeffries made it clear they intend to use their participation to continue highlighting Trump's role in the events of that day. So it sets the stage for another round of intense partisan fighting over the narrative of January 6th.
Finally, on the legislative side, but happening at the state level with big federal implications. Redistricting. Missouri approved a new map.
Yes, the Missouri State House approved a new congressional district map, passed mostly along party lines, 90 to 65.
And the goal is partisan advantage.
Explicitly. It's designed to give Republicans an additional U.S. House seat, aiming for a 7 Republican, 1 Democrat delegation up from the current 6-2 split.
Who is likely to lose their seat?
Representative Emanuel Cleaver, a Democrat who has represented Kansas City for a long time. The new map carves up his Kansas City base and adds heavily Republican rural areas to his district. Governor Kehoe called a special session specifically for this.
Is this expected to become law?
Yes, it's expected to pass the Republican-controlled state Senate and be signed by the governor, likely in time for the 2026 midterm elections.
And Missouri isn't alone in this.
Not at all. It's the latest front in a really escalating national redistricting war. Texas passed a map aiming to add 5 GOP seats. California Democrats are countering with a ballot measure to potentially redraw lines there and pick up 5 Democratic seats if another state, like Missouri, redistricts first.
A tit-for-tat battle.
Exactly. And other states like Florida and Maryland are reportedly eyeing redistricting as well. It's a high-stakes fight for control of the House, playing out state by state. The Congressional Black Caucus was actually scheduled to hold a press conference on Tuesday the 9th about Democratic efforts to push back against these GOP-led redistricting efforts. 3. The judicial branch, Supreme Court and federal courts.
All right, let's move to the third branch, the judiciary. And arguably, the most significant federal action during the September 6th to 9th window came from the Supreme Court, a landmark immigration ruling.
Absolutely. Noam V. Vasquez Perdomo. handed down on September 8th.
And this was through the shadow docket.
Yes, which is itself controversial. The court granted an emergency request from the Trump administration in a 6-3 vote.
What did the ruling do?
It immediately put on hold, or stayed, a temporary restraining order, TRO, that had been issued by a lower federal court judge in California.
What was that lower court order about?
U.S. District Judge Mam E. Frimpong had issued the TRO after finding what she called a mountain of evidence that ICE's operation at large in the Los Angeles area involved widespread, indiscriminate stops and arrests that violated the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures.
So the TRO restricted ICE's tactics?
Yes. It specifically prohibited ICE agents from using factors like a person's apparent race or ethnicity, whether they spoke Spanish or had accented English, their mere presence at known immigrant labor sites, or the type of work they did as the sole reason for stopping or detaining them.
And the Supreme Court lifted those restrictions? What was the majority's reasoning? Justice Kavanaugh wrote a concurrence explaining it.
He did. His concurrence laid out a few key arguments for why the majority granted the stay. First, he argued the government had a fair prospect of ultimately winning the case on its merits.
Based on what?
Primarily on the idea that the plaintiffs likely lacked legal standing to seek an injunction against future potential harms. He cited a precedent, Los Angeles v. Lyons, which often makes it hard to get injunctions against future police actions.
Okay, what about the Fourth Amendment issue? The factors the lower court barred.
Kavanaugh argued that courts must look at the totality of the particular circumstances. And he said that totality could include factors like ethnicity or language, especially when combined with other observations in areas known to have high populations of undocumented immigrants, to reach the threshold of reasonable suspicion.
Even though ethnicity alone isn't enough.
He acknowledged ethnicity alone is insufficient, but argued it can be a relevant factor in that totality. He also stated that preventing the government from enforcing federal immigration laws constitutes irreparable harm to the government itself, and that the threat of contempt sanctions against IC agents would inevitably chill lawful immigration enforcement efforts.
So essentially deferring to the executive branch's enforcement needs.
That's a fair reading. Broad discretion for enforcement.
But there was a powerful dissent from Justice Sotomayor.
Extremely powerful. Joined by Justices Kagan and Jackson, Sotomayor called the majority's decision a grave misuse of our emergency docket and unconscionably irreconcilable with our nation's constitutional guarantees.
Strong language.
Very. She recounted what she called harrowing accounts from the plaintiff's stories of violent seizures, including of U.S. citizens, by armed, masked agents. She characterized the approach as seize first and ask questions later.
And she disagreed fundamentally on the Fourth Amendment reasoning.
Absolutely. She argued forcefully that the factors the lower court prohibited, race, language, location, describe a very large category of presumably innocent people and simply cannot provide the individualized suspicion the Fourth Amendment demands. Her dissent really highlighted the potential impact on civil liberties.
This ruling seems huge. It dramatically shifts the landscape for immigration enforcement, right? Giving enormous power back to the executive.
Undeniably. The immediate effect is a green light for DHS to resume and likely intensify its most aggressive enforcement tactics, largely removing the judicial check that the TRO represented.
And DHS acknowledged this.
Yes. A spokesperson immediately hailed it as a major victory and vowed, quote, flood the zone in Los Angeles.
What are the broader implications for civil liberties?
Civil liberties groups are decrying it as effectively endorsing racial profiling. They warn it will create a pervasive climate of fear, potentially subjecting millions of U.S. citizens and legal residents to unconstitutional stops and seizures based simply on how they look, what language they speak, or where they live or work.
And legally. Politically.
The use of the shadow docket for such a consequential decision remains deeply contentious. It signals a court highly deferential to the executive, especially on immigration and national security, even when lower courts find strong evidence of constitutional violations. It weakens the power of lower courts as a check on the executive and sets a potentially lower standard for reasonable suspicion in this context. A major shift in power.
Beyond this specific ruling, there's been wider discussion about the Supreme Court's use of the shadow docket and its review of executive power, particularly the lack of detailed explanations in these emergency rulings.
Yes, that's become a significant point of friction. The Trump administration has been incredibly active in seeking emergency relief 25 applications in just 8 months. That's far more than the previous administration filed over 4 years.
And this lack of explanation is causing problems for lower courts.
It seems so. There was that case last month involving NIH grants tied to diversity programs. The Supreme Court allowed the cancellations via the shadow docket. Justice Gorsuch, joined by Kavanaugh, then accused a district judge of defying that ruling in a related case.
How did the judge respond?
District Judge William Young actually apologized, but pointed out how difficult it is for lower courts to interpret these often vague, unexplained interim orders from the Supreme Court. Even Justice Kavanaugh himself has publicly acknowledged that trying to reach consensus quickly on the shadow docket can lead to a lack of clarity and confusion.
And other federal judges are concerned, too.
NBC News reported speaking anonymously with a dozen federal judges, appointed by presidents of both parties, who criticized the lack of reasoning in these emergency SCOTUS decisions. One apparently said, "It is inexcusable. They don't have our backs." That indicates real tension.
Okay, another major case involving executive power. The firing of FTC Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter.
Right. On Monday, September 8th, Chief Justice John Roberts issued a temporary order allowing President Trump's firing of Commissioner Slaughter to proceed while the full court considers the administration's emergency appeal.
And this case challenges longstanding precedent.
It does. The president is trying to fire Slaughter, an independent agency commissioner, without cause. This directly challenges a 90-year-old Supreme Court precedent, Humphrey's executor, that generally protects such commissioners from removal, except for specific reasons like inefficiency or malfeasance.
What did Roberts' order say?
Nothing, really. It contained no explanation, which is typical for these temporary administrative stays while an emergency application is pending. But the implications are huge.
Because the court could overturn that precedent.
Exactly. This case could be the vehicle for the Supreme Court to overturn Humphrey's executor and significantly expand presidential power over independent regulatory agencies, potentially undermining their independence.
In contrast to those rulings favoring executive power, we saw courts push back on the administration's transgender passport policy.
Yes, a second federal court weighed in. On Tuesday, September 9th, a federal judge ordered the administration to process passport applications for six transgender and non-binary individuals using sex markers that reflect their gender identity.
This is a preliminary injunction.
Correct. A temporary halt to the State Department's policy while the case proceeds. This follows a similar ruling back in June by another federal judge, which halted the denial of updated passports to any transgender, non-binary, or intersex American seeking to change their sex designation.
What was the policy they're challenging?
The State Department had suspended processing these applications back in January. This came after President Trump signed an executive order proclaiming that the government would only recognize two unchangeable sexes, male and female, determined at birth, and mandated government IDs reflect that sex at birth.
So two courts have now blocked this policy.
Yes, both finding that the plaintiffs were suffering irreparable harm. It shows that while the Supreme Court might be deferential in some areas, lower federal courts are still acting as a check on certain executive actions, at least for now.
And one final court item, the E. Jean Carroll defamation award against President Trump was upheld.
Yes, on Monday, September 8th. A three-judge panel on a federal appeals court unanimously upheld the $83.3 million defamation award. They rejected Trump's claims that presidential immunity should shield him from the lawsuit related to statements he made denying Carroll's sexual assault allegation. So that very substantial judgment remains in place. 4. The administrative state. Rulemaking and implementation.
All right, let's shift from the courts to the engine room of government implementation, the administrative state. This is where executive orders and laws get translated into actual rules and actions. The Federal Register is key here.
Absolutely. It's the official daily publication for rules, proposed rules, and notices of federal agencies and organizations, as well as executive orders and other presidential documents.
And the public inspection list for September 9th confirmed the formal publication of several EOs we've discussed.
That's right. It showed the formal filing and upcoming publication for EO 14347, Restoring the United States Department of War.
Also, the trade orders.
Yes. EO 14346, modifying the scope of reciprocal tariffs, and EO 14345, implementing the United States-Japan Agreement, which was signed back on the 4th but officially published now, plus that unnumbered order on protecting U.S. nationals from wrongful detention abroad.
And publication in the Federal Register is what gives them legal force.
Correct. It's the official notice that triggers action by federal agencies. For example, after the Japan trade EO was published, U.S. Customs and Border Protection immediately issued guidance to its officers on how to implement the new tariff rates, including the retroactive application. It shows how quickly the bureaucracy responds once an order is official.
Beyond those high-profile EOs, there was a lot of other regulatory activity, right? Business as usual for many agencies.
Definitely. A huge volume of rulemaking and notices. One particularly significant item filed for publication was a major final rule from the Department of Education.
What was it about?
It's about 100 pages long, titled Final Priority, Secretary's Supplemental Priorities and Definitions on Evidence-Based Literacy, Education Choice, and Returning Education to the States.
Sounds like the nitty-gritty details of their education agenda.
Precisely. This is where broad policy goals get translated into specific regulations that affect schools, funding, and curriculum across the country.
What else stood out?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security, specifically the Coast Guard, filed final rules updating Anchorage ground regulations in California and rules for recurring marine events in Florida. The FAA filed multiple rules, airworthiness directives for certain helicopter models, amendments to standard instrument approach procedures for various airports.
So the essential, often technical work of government continues.
Absolutely. Plus lots of routine notices. CDC and FCC seeking public comment on information collections, notices of meetings for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, Army Corps of Engineers, environmental impact statements, the daily work of the administrative state.
Okay, let's talk about the Make America Healthy Again, or MAA, strategy. A second report was released on Tuesday, September 9th.
Yes. This report focuses specifically on the administration's planned health strategy for children.
What are the main priorities?
It covers a range of topics. Vaccines, childhood nutrition, water fluoridation, and exposure to chemicals.
What are some key initiatives proposed?
One is creating a new initiative on chronic disease within the NIH, aiming to coordinate research better and generate actionable results for diseases affecting both children and adults.
There's also an awareness campaign.
Yes, a Make American Schools Healthy Again awareness campaign. Mm. It involves HHS, USDA, the Department of Education, and the President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition, all promoting physical activity and better nutrition in schools.
What about vaccines? That's been a contentious area.
Very. The report outlines plans for a vaccine framework developed by the White House Domestic Policy Council and HHS. The stated goals include ensuring the best childhood vaccine schedule, addressing alleged vaccine injuries, modernizing vaccines, ensuring scientific and medical freedom, and correcting conflicts of interest.
How is that being received by health experts?
With a significant alarm. Given the administration's general skepticism towards vaccination, public health experts worry this framework could undermine established science, weaken vaccine confidence, and potentially lead to outbreaks of preventable diseases. The report also mentions restructuring HHS to include a new administration for a healthy America.
The strategy also touches on chemicals and environmental health. Fluoride, PFAS.
Yes. It calls for reforming chemical and pesticide approval processes, ostensibly to protect against pests while increasing innovative growing solutions. The CDC is tasked with updating recommendations for water fluoridation, acknowledging dental benefits, but also noting some studies linking high levels to IQ impacts.
And PFAS, those forever chemicals.
The report indicates the Trump administration plans to retain but delay implementation of standards for two types of PFAS set by the previous administration, and to remove and reevaluate standards for four others. This contrasts sharply with the Biden administration's move to set the first ever national drinking water standards for six types of PFAS. So, a significant potential rollback of regulations there.
What about medications and diet?
HHS is set to create a mental health diagnosis and prescription working group to look at prescribing patterns for psychiatric meds, particularly in children. NIH and FDA are tasked with exploring the repurposing of existing drugs for chronic diseases.
And dietary guidelines.
Policy reforms mentioned include updating dietary guidelines, limiting petroleum-based food dyes, reevaluating other food additives, and promoting higher breastfeeding rates.
Were these topics discussed in Congress?
Yes. Health officials and experts were scheduled to testify about children's health medication, diet, wellness before a House Oversight Subcommittee on Tuesday afternoon. So it's getting legislative attention, too.
There was also some related commentary, an opinion piece.
Yes, an opinion piece on September 9th by Joseph was quite critical of what it called MAGA moms for anti-vaccine rhetoric, linking it to a public health crisis and arguing it endangers children. The piece noted that while only about 22% of Americans oppose vaccination, this minority holds disproportionate political influence and often overlaps with opposition to things like gun control and environmental protection.
And while this policy debate unfolds, the CDC issued some immediate health warnings.
Yes, two notable ones on Tuesday, September 9th. First, increased awareness about Chagas disease, also known as kissing bug disease.
Where is that a concern?
It's now been reported in 32 states. It's transmitted by tritominate insects or kissing bugs and can cause serious long-term heart and digestive problems. The CDC reported about 280,000 cases in the U.S. contracted either through bug bites here or elsewhere. They emphasize prevention, sealing homes, using insecticides, bed nets, careful food preparation in affected areas.
And the second warning.
The Salmonella outbreak linked to a home delivery meal service called Metabolic Meals.
How widespread?
At the time of the report, 16 people were sickened across 10 states from Arkansas to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
The CDC noted the true number is likely higher, as many cases go unreported. Metabolic Meals was contacting customers, but a formal recall hadn't been issued yet.
It really raises a question, doesn't it? How effectively can the administrative state juggle implementing these broad, often politically charged executive agendas while also responding quickly and effectively to urgent, on-the-ground public health threats like these outbreaks?
It's a constant challenge. The rulemaking process is inherently slow and deliberative, designed for checks and balances. But public health crises demand rapid, evidence-based action. Add political pressures and directives into the mix, and it becomes incredibly complex for agencies to navigate.
So looking at the administrative state this week, a constant flow of activity, some translating big-picture agendas into detailed rules, some dealing with immediate crises, a complex machine under pressure.
Exactly. Implementing policy, enforcing regulations, and responding to new challenges, all happening simultaneously. V-synthesis and forward outlook, connecting the dots.
Okay, we've covered a massive amount of detail in this deep dive, looking at the U.S. federal government's actions just between September 6th and 9th, 2025. Stepping back, what's the big picture? What's the dominant theme emerging from this period?
I think one theme comes through loud and clear: executive primacy. The executive branch was absolutely the main engine driving the national agenda during these few days.
Using unilateral directives.
Absolutely. In defense with the Department of War, in trade with the Japan deal, in domestic policy with immigration enforcement and initiatives like America Prays, major policy shifts driven directly from the top.
And Congress.
Largely secondary. Mm. Minimal floor activity operating under that CR. Congress functioned more as a platform for oversight hearings. And even those often seem to amplify or react to the administration's priorities rather than setting an independent legislative course.
You mentioned that idea of Congress choosing irrelevance.
Yeah, that framework suggests that in hyperpartisan times, avoiding tough votes or direct confrontation with a powerful executive can sometimes seem like a survival strategy for legislators, but it inherently cedes power.
And the judicial branch, particularly the Supreme Court.
In this period, especially with the 6-3 shadow docket ruling in Non vivas quis perdomo, the Supreme Court acted less like a check and more like an enabler of executive power, at least in the critical area of immigration enforcement. It provided the legal green light for controversial policies to move forward.
So it all converges towards a more centralized governance model.
It seems that way. Policy dictated top down, with less need for legislative consensus or compromise. This shift in the balance of power, with a potentially sidelined Congress and a deferential judiciary in key areas, has really significant implications for accountability and the traditional separation of powers.
Looking closer, were these actions just isolated incidents, or was there coordination?
There definitely appears to be a coordinated multi-front strategy at play. You see real synergy between the actions. Well, take the Department of War rebranding. It provides the ideological framing for a more assertive foreign policy.
And that's backed up by action?
Yes. Like the reported deployment of F-35s to the Caribbean amid Venezuela tensions, or that kinetic strike against the alleged drug vessel.
Mm-hmm.
The rhetoric matches the action.
And the Supreme Court ruling fits in.
Perfectly. The Noem v. Vasquez Perdomo decision provides the legal cover needed to execute the administration's aggressive domestic immigration enforcement agenda.
While Congress holds hearings.
Hearings on topics like union antisemitism or government efficiency can be used to investigate and apply pressure to political opponents or groups perceived as hostile to the administration's goals. It creates this powerful feedback loop.
Advancing the agenda on multiple fronts at once.
Exactly. Amplifying the overall impact. It looked like a very integrated approach.
So looking ahead, based on these trends, what are the implications? For international partners, for instance.
For international partners, I think they should brace for a U.S. foreign and economic policy that continues to be highly transactional, often unpredictable, and generally dismissive of traditional multilateral norms and institutions.
The Japan deal is the model.
It looks like it. Expect demands for large-scale direct investment into the U.S. as the price for tariff relief or other favorable treatment. And the Department of War branding signals, at minimum, a lower rhetorical threshold for considering military force, particularly maybe in the Western Hemisphere.
What about domestic businesses?
It's a mixed bag. There are clear opportunities in sectors targeted for investment under these new trade models. Semiconductors, critical minerals, energy will likely see huge capital inflows.
But the downside?
The broader protectionist tariff environment creates ongoing supply chain uncertainty and likely higher input costs for many businesses, which can translate to higher consumer prices. And navigating regulatory compliance will only get more complex with all these new executive directives and agency rulemakings on existing laws.
We saw that clash with the ICE raid in Georgia.
Exactly. The raid on the Hyundai factory detaining South Korean workers really highlighted how the administration's economic policies aimed at attracting foreign investment can collide head-on with its aggressive immigration enforcement, creating unexpected risks and headaches for businesses.
And finally, for civil society, for the public.
The Supreme Court's immigration ruling is profound. It will almost certainly have a chilling effect on immigrant communities, documented or not, and it raises fundamental questions about the strength of Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches and seizures for everyone.
And the focus on cultural issues.
That seems set to continue, deepening political polarization. Expect public institutions, schools, universities, even workplaces to become more intense ideological battlegrounds over issues like prayer, curriculum, and woke ideology.
Will legal challenges continue?
Oh, certainly. But as we discussed, with a Supreme Court that appears highly deferential to the executive in key areas, the path for those legal challenges seems increasingly narrow and uncertain.
We also saw reminders of other societal pressures. Crime, education.
Yes. The tragic murder of Irina Zarutska in Charlotte brought debates about violent crime, media coverage, and mental health policy back into focus. And those dismal national report card scores showing decades-low performance in reading, math, and science for 8th and 12th graders. That raises deep concerns about the future workforce and overall societal health.
So for you, the listener, trying to make sense of all this, it really underscores the need to stay informed, doesn't it? Not just about what happened, but the connections, the why.
Absolutely. Understanding the interconnectedness is crucial.
We have certainly covered a huge amount today, from military rebranding to landmark court rulings, trade deals, public health. It's clear these federal actions, even over just a few days, have ripples everywhere.
Indeed. And this constant push and pull we've explored between presidential power, Congress's role, the court's interpretation, it genuinely shapes not just policy details, but the fundamental nature of our society.
And the big question lingers, right? In an era of such decisive, often unilateral executive action, how will the other branches adapt? What balance will eventually be struck, especially with those huge underlying challenges?
Like the national debt, now reaching $37 trillion you mentioned. That keeps accumulating, regardless of the daily headlines, the debates around interest rates, the Fed's independence. Those are ticking clocks alongside everything else.
Exactly. It reminds us that while some actions grab the spotlight, these slower-moving economic pressures have immense long-term consequences. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the federal news update. We hope you feel more informed, maybe a little more equipped to follow these threads.
And maybe a bit more curious. Remember, understanding these complex connections really is key to making sense of the world unfolding around us. Until next time.